Human Universe by Brian Cox and Andrew Cohen. What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason! How infinite in faculties, in form and moving, how express and admirable! In action, how like an angel! In apprehension, how like a god! The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals! And yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me. No, nor woman neither, though by your smiling you seem to say so. Hamlet. What is a human being? Objectively, nothing of consequence. Particles of dust in an infinite arena, present for an instant in eternity. Clumps of atoms in a universe with more galaxies than people. And yet a human being is necessary for the question itself to exist. And the presence of a question in the universe, any question, is the most wonderful thing. Questions require minds, and minds bring meaning. What is meaning? I don't know. Except that the universe and every pointless speck inside it mean something to me. I am astonished by the existence of a single atom, and find my civilization to be an outrageous imprint on reality. I don't understand it. Nobody does. But it makes me smile. This book asks questions about our origins, our destiny, and our place in the universe. We have no right to expect answers. We have no right to even ask. But ask and wonder we do. Human Universe is first and foremost a love letter to humanity, a celebration of our outrageous fortune in existing at all. I've chosen to write my letter in the language of science, because there is no better demonstration of our magnificent ascent from dust to paragon of animals than the exponentiation of knowledge generated by science. 2 million years ago, we were ape men. Now, we are spacemen. This has happened, as far as we know, nowhere else. That is worth celebrating. Chapter 1. Where are we? We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. T.S. Eliot. Oakbank Avenue, Chadderton, Oldham, Greater Manchester, England, United Kingdom, Europe, Earth, Milky Way, Observable Universe. For me, it was an early 1960s brick-built bungalow on Oakbank Avenue. If the wind was blowing from the east, you could smell vinegar coming from Sarson's Brewery, although these were rare days in Oldham, a town usually subjected to westerlies dumping Atlantic moisture onto the textile mills, dampening their red brick in a permanent sheen against the sodden sky. On a good day, though, you'd take the vinegar in return for sunlight on the moors. Oldham looks like Joy Division sounds, and I like Joy Division. There was a newsagent on the corner of Kenilworth Avenue and Middleton Road, and on Fridays my granddad would take me there and we'd buy a toy, usually a little car or truck. I've still got most of them. When I was older, I'd play tennis on the red cinder courts in Chadderton Hall Park and drink woodpecker cider on the bench in the grounds of St. Matthew's Church. One autumn evening, just after the start of the school year and after a few sips, I had my first kiss there, all cold nose and sniffles. I suppose that sort of behaviour is frowned upon these days. The bloke in the off-licence would have been prosecuted by Oldham Council's underage cider czar, and I'd be on a list. But I survived, and eventually I left Oldham for the University of Manchester. Everyone has an Oakbank Avenue, a place in space at the beginning of our time, central to an expanding personal universe. For our distant ancestors in the East African Rift, their expansion was one of physical experience alone. But for a human fortunate to be born in the latter half of the 20th century in a country like mine, education powers the mind beyond direct experience, onwards and outwards, and in the case of this little boy, towards the stars. As England stomped its way through the 1970s, I learned my place amongst the continents and oceans of our blue planet. I could tell you about polar bears on Arctic ice floes, or gazelle grazing on central plains long before I physically left our shores. I discovered that our Earth is one planet amongst nine, now redefined as eight, tracing out an elliptical orbit around an average star with Mercury and Venus on the inside, and Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune beyond. The Sun is one star amongst 400 billion in the Milky Way galaxy, itself just one galaxy amongst 350 billion in the observable universe. Later, at university, I discovered that physical reality extends way beyond the 90 billion light-year visible sphere into, if I had to guess based on my 46-year immersion in the combined knowledge of human civilization, infinity. This is my ascent into insignificance. A road travelled by many, and yet one that remains intensely personal to each individual who takes it. The routes we follow through the ever-growing landscape of human knowledge are chaotic. The delayed turn of a page in a stumbled-upon book can lead to a lifetime of exploration. But there are common themes amongst our disparate intellectual journeys, and the relentless relegation from center stage that inevitably followed the development of modern astronomy has had a powerful effect on our shared experience. I am certain that the voyage from the center of creation to an infinitesimally tiny speck should be termed an ascent, the most glorious intellectual climb. Of course, I also recognize that there are many who have struggled and continue to struggle with such a dizzying physical relegation. John Updike once wrote that astronomy is what we have now instead of theology. The terrors are less, but the comforts are nil. For me, the choice between fear and elation is a matter of perspective, and it is a central aim of this book to make the case for elation. This may appear at first sight to be a difficult challenge. The very title, Human Universe, appears to demonstrate an unjustifiable solipsism. How can a possibly infinite reality be viewed through the prism of a bunch of biological machines temporarily inhabiting a mote of dust? My answer to that is that Human Universe is a love letter to humanity, because our mote of dust is the only place where love certainly exists. This sounds like a return to the anthropocentric vision we held for so long, and which science has done so much to destroy in a million humble cuts. Perhaps. But let me offer an alternative view. There is only one corner of the universe where we know for sure that the laws of nature have conspired to produce a species capable of transcending the physical bounds of a single life, and developing a library of knowledge beyond the capacity of a million individual brains, which contains a precise description of our location in space and time. We know our place, and that makes us valuable, and at least in our local cosmic neighborhood, unique. We don't know how far we would have to travel to find another such island of understanding, but it is surely a long, long way. This makes the human race worth celebrating, our library worth nurturing, and our existence worth protecting. Building on these ideas, my view is that we humans represent an isolated island of meaning in a meaningless universe. And I should immediately clarify what I mean by meaningless. I see no reason for the existence of the universe in a teleological sense. There is surely no final cause or purpose. Rather, I think that meaning is an emergent property. It appeared on Earth when the brains of our ancestors became large enough to allow for primitive culture, probably between 3 and 4 million years ago, with the emergence of Australopithecus in the Rift Valley. There are surely other intelligent beings in the billions of galaxies beyond the Milky Way, and if the modern theory of eternal inflation is correct, then there is an infinite number of inhabited worlds in the multiverse beyond the horizon. I am much less certain that there are large numbers of civilizations sharing our galaxy, however, which is why I use the term isolated. If we are currently alone in the Milky Way, then the vast distances between the galaxies probably mean that we will never get to discuss our situation with anyone else. We will encounter all these ideas and arguments later in this book, and I will carefully separate my opinion from that of science, or rather, what we know with a level of certainty. But it is worth noting that the modern picture of a vast and possibly infinite cosmos, populated with uncountable worlds, has a long and violent history. And the often visceral reaction to the physical demotion of humanity lays bare deeply held prejudices and comfortable assumptions that sit, perhaps, at the core of our being. It seems appropriate, therefore, to begin this tour of the human universe with a controversial figure whose life and death resonates with many of these intellectual and emotional challenges. Giordano Bruno is as famous for his death as for his life and work. On the 17th of February 1600, his tongue pinioned to prevent him from repeating his heresy, which recalls the stoning scene in Monty Python's Life of Brian when the admonishment, "You're only making it worse for yourself," is correctly observed to be an empty threat, Bruno was burned at the stake in the Campo dei Fiori in Rome, and his ashes thrown into the Tiber. His crimes were numerous and included heretical ideas such as denying the divinity of Jesus. It is also the opinion of many historians that Bruno was irritating, argumentative, and, not to put too fine a point on it, an all-round pain in the arse. So many powerful people were simply glad to see the back of him. But it is also true that Bruno embraced and promoted a wonderful idea that raises important and challenging questions. Bruno believed that the universe is infinite and filled with an infinite number of habitable worlds. He also believed that although each world exists for a brief moment when compared to the life of the universe, space itself is neither created nor destroyed. The universe is eternal. Although the precise reasons for Bruno's death sentence are still debated amongst historians, the idea of an infinite and eternal universe seems to have been central to his fate, because it clearly raises questions about the role of a creator. Bruno knew this, of course, which is why his return to Italy in 1591, after a safe, successful existence in the more tolerant atmosphere of northern Europe, remains a mystery. During the 1580s, Bruno enjoyed the patronage of both King Henry III of France and Queen Elizabeth I of England, loudly promoting the Copernican ideal of a sun-centred solar system. Whilst it's often assumed that the very idea of removing the Earth from the centre of the solar system was enough to elicit a violent response from the Church, Copernicanism itself was not considered heretical in 1600, and the infamous tussles with Galileo lay 30 years in the future. Rather, it was Bruno's philosophical idea of an eternal universe, requiring no point of creation, which unsettled the Church authorities and perhaps paved the way for their later battles with astronomy and science. As we shall see, the idea of a universe that existed before the Big Bang is now central to modern cosmology, and falls very much within the realm of observational and theoretical science. In my view, this presents as great a challenge to modern-day theologians as it did in Bruno's time, so it's perhaps no wonder that he was dispensed with. Bruno, then, was a complex figure, and his contributions to science are questionable. He was more belligerent free thinker than proto-scientist, and whilst there's no shame in that, the intellectual origins of our ascent into insignificance lie elsewhere. Bruno was a brash, if portentous, messenger who would likely not have reached his heretical conclusions about an infinite and eternal universe without the work of Nicholas Copernicus, grounded in what can now clearly be recognised as one of the earliest examples of modern science, and published over half a century before Bruno's cinematic demise. Off-centre. Nicholas Copernicus was born in the Polish city of Torun in 1473 and benefited from a superb education after being enrolled at the University of Krakow at 18 by his influential uncle, the Bishop of Warmia. In 1496, intending to follow in the footsteps of his uncle, Copernicus moved to Bologna to study canon law, where he lodged with an astronomy professor, Domenico Maria de Novara, who had a reputation for questioning the classical works of the ancient Greeks, and in particular their widely accepted cosmology. The classical view of the universe was based on Aristotle's not unreasonable assertion that the Earth is at the centre of all things and that everything moves around it. This feels right, because we don't perceive ourselves to be in motion, and the sun, moon, planets and stars appear to sweep across the sky around us. However, A little careful observation reveals that the situation is in fact more complicated than this. In particular, the planets perform little loops in the sky at certain times of year, reversing their track across the background stars before continuing along their paths through the constellations of the zodiac. This observational fact, which is known as retrograde motion, occurs because we are viewing the planets from a moving vantage point, the Earth, in orbit around the Sun. This is by far the simplest explanation for the evidence, although it is possible to construct a system capable of predicting the positions of the planets months or years ahead and maintain Earth's unique stationary position at the centre of all things. Such an Earth-centred model was developed by Ptolemy in the 2nd century and published in his most famous work, Almagest. The details are extremely complicated and aren't worth describing in detail here because the central idea is totally wrong and we won't learn anything. The sheer contrived complexity of an Earth-centred description of planetary motions can be seen in Ptolemy's model, which shows the apparent motions of the planets against the stars as viewed from Earth. This tangled Ptolemaic system of Earth-centred circular motions, replete with the arcane terminology of epicycles, deferents, and equant, was used successfully by astrologers for thousands of years to predict where the planets would be against the constellations of the zodiac, presumably allowing them to write their horoscopes and mislead the gullible citizens of the ancient world. And if all you care about are the predictions themselves, and your philosophical prejudice and common sense feeling of stillness require the Earth to be at the centre, then everything is fine. And so it remained until Copernicus became sufficiently offended by the sheer ugliness of the Ptolemaic model to do something about it. Copernicus's precise objections to Ptolemy are not known, but sometime around 1510, he wrote an unpublished manuscript called the Commentariolus, in which he expressed his dissatisfaction with the model. I often considered whether there could perhaps be found a more reasonable arrangement of circles, from which every apparent irregularity would be derived, while everything in itself would move uniformly, as is required by the rule of perfect motion. The Commentariolus contained a list of radical and mostly correct assertions. Copernicus wrote that the moon revolves around the Earth, the planets rotate around the Sun, and the distance from the Earth to the Sun is an insignificant fraction of the distance to the stars. He was the first to suggest that the Earth rotates on its axis, and that this rotation is responsible for the daily motion of the Sun and stars across the sky. He also understood that the retrograde motion of the planets is due to the motion of the Earth and not the planets themselves. Copernicus always intended Commentariolus to be the introduction to a much larger work, and included little, if any, detail about how he had come upon such a radical departure from classical ideas. The full justification for and description of his new cosmology took him a further 20 years, but by 1539 he had finished most of his 6-volume De Revolutionibus, although the completed books were not published until 1543. They contained the mathematical elaborations of his heliocentric model, an analysis of the precession of the equinoxes, the orbit of the moon, and a catalogue of the stars, and are rightly regarded as foundational works in the development of modern science. They were widely read in universities across Europe and admired for the accuracy of the astronomical predictions contained within. It's interesting to note, however, that the intellectual turmoil caused by our relegation from the centre of all things still coloured the view of many of the great scientific names of the age. Tycho Brahe, the greatest astronomical observer before the invention of the telescope, referred to Copernicus as a second Ptolemy, which was meant as a compliment, but didn't accept the sun-centred solar system model in its entirety, partly because he perceived it to be in contradiction with the Bible, but partly because it does seem obvious that the Earth is at rest. This is not a trivial objection to a Copernican solar system, and a truly modern understanding of precisely what at rest and moving mean requires Einstein's theories of relativity, which we'll get to later. Even Copernicus himself was clear that the Sun still rested at the centre of the universe. But as the 17th century wore on, precision observations greatly improved, due to the invention of the telescope and an increasingly mature application of mathematics to describe the data, and led a host of astronomers and mathematicians, including Johannes Kepler, Galileo, and ultimately Isaac Newton, towards an understanding of the workings of the solar system. This theory is good enough even today to send space probes to the outer planets with absolute precision. At first sight, it's difficult to understand why Ptolemy's contrived mess lasted so long. But there is a modern bias to this statement that is revealing. Today, a scientifically literate person assumes that there is a real, predictable universe beyond Earth that operates according to laws of nature, the same laws that objects obey here on Earth. This idea, which is correct, only emerged fully formed with the work of Isaac Newton in the 1680s, over a century after Copernicus. Ancient astronomers were interested primarily in predictions, and although the nature of physical reality was debated, the central scientific idea of universal laws of physics had simply not been discovered. Ptolemy created a model that makes predictions that agree with observation to a reasonable level of accuracy, and that was good enough for most people. There had been notable dissenting voices, of course. The history of ideas is never linear. Epicurus, writing around 300 BCE, proposed an eternal cosmos populated by an infinity of worlds, and around the same time Aristarchus proposed a sun-centered universe about which the Earth and planets orbit. There was also a strong tradition of classic orthodoxy in the Islamic world in the 10th and 11th centuries. The astronomer and mathematician Ibn al-Haytham pointed out that whilst Ptolemy's model had predictive power, the motions of the planets represent an arrangement that is impossible to exist. The end of the revolution started by Copernicus around 1510 and the beginning of modern mathematical physics can be dated to the 5th of July 1687 when Isaac Newton published the Principia. He demonstrated that the Earth-centered Ptolemaic jumble can be replaced by a sun-centered solar system and a law of universal gravitation, which applies to all objects in the universe and can be expressed in a single mathematical equation, F equals G times M1 M2 over R squared. The equation says that the gravitational force between two objects, a planet and a star, say, of masses M1 and M2, can be calculated by multiplying the masses together, dividing by the square of the distance R between them, and multiplying by G, which encodes the strength of the gravitational force itself. G, which is known as Newton's constant, is, as far as we know, a fundamental property of our universe. It is a single number which is the same everywhere and has remained so for all time. Henry Cavendish first measured G in a famous experiment in 1798 in which he managed, indirectly, to measure the gravitational force between lead balls of known mass using a torsion balance. This is yet another example of the central idea of modern physics. Lead balls obey the same laws of nature as stars and planets. For the record, the current best measurement of G is 6.67 times 10 to the minus 11 newton meter squared per kilogram squared, which tells you that the gravitational force between two balls of mass 1 kilogram each 1 meter apart is just less than 10,000 millionths of a newton. Gravity is a very weak force indeed, and this is why its strength was not measured until 71 years after Newton's death. This is a quite brilliant simplification, and perhaps more importantly, the pivotal discovery of the deep relationship between mathematics and nature which underpins the success of science, described so eloquently by the philosopher and mathematician Bertrand Russell. Mathematics, rightly viewed, possesses not only truth, but supreme beauty, a beauty cold and austere like that of sculpture, without appeal to any part of our weaker nature, without the gorgeous trappings of painting or music, yet sublimely pure, and capable of a stern perfection such as only the greatest art can show. The true spirit of delight, the exaltation, the sense of being more than man, which is the touchstone of the highest excellence, is to be found in mathematics as surely as in poetry. Nowhere is this sentiment made more clearly manifest than in Newton's law of gravitation. Given the position and velocity of the planets at a single moment, the geometry of the solar system at any time millions of years into the future can be calculated. Compare that economy, you could write all the necessary information on the back of an envelope, with Ptolemy's whirling offset epicycles. Physicists greatly prize such economy. If a large array of complex phenomena can be described by a simple law or equation, this usually implies that we are on the right track. The quest for elegance and economy in the description of nature guides theoretical physicists to this day, and will form a central part of our story as we trace the development of modern cosmology. Seen in this light, Copernicus assumes even greater historical importance. Not only did he catalyze the destruction of the Earth-centered cosmos, but he inspired Brahe, Kepler, Galileo, Newton, and many others towards the development of modern mathematical physics, which is not only remarkably successful in its description of the universe, but was also necessary for the emergence of our modern technological civilization. Take note, politicians, economists, and science policy advisers of the 21st century. A prerequisite for the creation of the intellectual edifice upon which your spreadsheets, air-conditioned offices, and mobile phones rest was the curiosity-driven quest to understand the motions of the planets and the Earth's place amongst the stars. Matching the observations of the wandering stars, the planets, of the night sky with the idea that the Earth was at the center of the solar system required extremely complex models. In the case of Venus, combining the Earth at the center with the observations meant that Venus had a circular orbit around a point midway between the Earth and the Sun, so-called epicycles, with all the other planets having similar complicated orbits around various points scattered around the solar system. Placing the Sun at the center of the solar system, with the planets arranged in their familiar order, with the Moon orbiting the Earth, gave a much simpler system. Changing perspective. 1968 was a difficult year on planet Earth. The Vietnam War, the bloodiest of Cold War proxy tussles, was at its height, ultimately claiming over 3 million lives. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, prompting presidential hopeful Bobby Kennedy to ask the people of the United States to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. Kennedy himself was assassinated before the year was out. Elsewhere, Russian tanks rolled into Prague, and France teetered on the edge of revolution. As I approached my first Christmas, my parents could have been forgiven for wondering what kind of world their son would inhabit in 1969. And then, as Christmas Eve drifted into Christmas morning, an unexpected snowfall decorated Oak Bank Avenue, and Borman, Lovell and Anders, 400,000 kilometres away, saved 1968. Apollo 8 was, in the eyes of many, the moon mission that had the most profound historical impact. It was a terrific, noble risk, a magnificent roll of the dice, a distillation of all that is great about exploration, a tribute to the sheer balls of the astronauts and engineers who decided that, come what may, they would honour President Kennedy's pledge to send a giant rocket, more than 300 feet tall, the length of this football field, made of new metal alloys, some of which have not been invented, capable of standing heat and stresses several times more than have ever been experienced, fitted together with a precision better than the finest watch, carrying all the equipment needed for propulsion, guidance, control, communications, food, and survival, on an untried mission to an unknown celestial body, and then return it safely to Earth, re-entering the atmosphere at speeds of over 40,000 kilometers per hour, causing heat about half that of the temperature of the sun, almost as hot as it is here today, and do all this, and do it right, and do it first, before this decade is out. If I heard that from a leader today, I'd be first on the rocket. Instead, I have to listen to vacuous diatribes about fairness, hard-working families, and how we're all in it together. Sod that, I want to go to Mars. To set Apollo 8 in context, Apollo 7, the first manned test flight of the Apollo program, was flown by Schirra, Eisele, and Cunningham in October 1968. Apollo 8 was supposed to be a December test flight for the lunar lander, conducted in the familiar surroundings of Earth orbit, but delivery delays meant that it was not ready for flight, and the aim of meeting Kennedy's deadline looked to be dead. But this wasn't the 21st century, it was the 1960s, and NASA was run by engineers. The program manager was George Lowe, an Army veteran and an aeronautical engineer who knew the spacecraft inside out and had the strength of character to make decisions. Why not send Apollo 8 directly to the moon without the lunar lander, proposed Lowe, allowing Apollo 9 to test fly the LEM, Lunar Excursion Module, in Earth orbit in early 1969 when it became available, and pave the way for a landing before the decade was out. Virtually every engineer at NASA is said to have agreed, and so it was that only the second manned flight of the Apollo spacecraft lifted off from Kennedy on the 21st of December, 10 short weeks after Apollo 7, bound for the moon. The crew later said that they estimated their chance of succeeding to be 50-50. Precisely 69 hours, 8 minutes and 16 seconds after launch, the command module's engine fired to slow the spacecraft down and allow it to be captured by the moon's gravity, putting the three astronauts into lunar orbit. Newton's almost 300-year-old equations were used to calculate the trajectory. This was a spectacular, practically unbelievable engineering triumph. Less than a decade after Yuri Gagarin became the first human to orbit the Earth, three astronauts travelled all the way to the moon. But the mission's powerful and enduring cultural legacy rests largely on two very human actions by the crew. One was the famous and moving Christmas broadcast, the most watched television event in history at that time, when distant explorers read the first lines from the book of Genesis. "We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you," began Anders. "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep." Borman concluded with a sentence clearly spoken by a lonely man 400,000 kilometers from home. "And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth." The mission's most potent legacy, however, is NASA image AS8142383, snapped by Bill Anders on a Hasselblad 500 EL at F11 and a shutter speed of 1/250th of a second on Kodak ektachrome film. It was, in other words, a very bright photograph. The image is better known as Earthrise. When viewed with the lunar surface at the bottom, Earth is tilted on its side with the South Pole to the left and the equator running top to bottom. Little landmass can be seen through the swirling clouds, but the bright sands of the Namib and Saharan deserts stand out salmon pink against the blackness beyond. Just 368 years and 10 months after a man was burned at the stake for dreaming of worlds without end, here is Earth, a fragile crescent suspended over an alien landscape, the negative of a waxing moon in the friendly skies of Earth. This is an unfamiliar planetary Earth, no longer central, just another world. When Kennedy spoke of Apollo as a journey to an unknown celestial body, he meant the moon. But we discovered Earth, and in the words of T.S. Eliot, came to know the place for the first time. Outwards to the Milky Way. Newton's laws are the keys to understanding our place in our local neighbourhood. Coupled with precision observations of the motion of the planets and moons, they allow the scale and geometry of the solar system to be deduced and their positions to be calculated at any point in the future. The nature and location of the stars, however, requires an entirely different approach, because at first sight they appear to be point-like and fixed. The observation that the stars don't appear to move is important if you know something about parallax, as the ancients did. Parallax is the name given to a familiar effect. Hold your finger up in front of your face and alternately close each of your eyes, keeping your finger still. Your finger appears to move relative to the more distant background, and the closer your finger is to your face, the more it appears to move. This is not an optical illusion. It's a consequence of viewing a nearby object from two different spatial positions, in this case, the two slightly different positions of your eyes. We don't normally perceive this parallax effect because the brain combines the inputs from the eyes to create a single image, although the information is exploited to create our sense of depth. Aristotle used the lack of stellar parallax to argue that the Earth must be stationary at the centre of the universe, because if the Earth moved, then the nearby stars would be observed to move against the background of the more distant ones. Thousands of years later, Tycho Brahe used a similar argument to refute the conclusions reached by Copernicus. Their logic was completely sound, but the conclusion is wrong because the nearby stars do move relative to the more distant background stars as the Earth orbits the Sun, and indeed as the Sun orbits the galaxy itself. You just have to look extremely carefully to see the effect. Amongst the thousands of stars visible to the naked eye, 61 Cygni is one of the faintest. It's not without interest, being a binary star system of two orange K-type dwarf stars, slightly smaller and cooler than the Sun, orbiting each other at the lethargic rate of around 700 years. Despite the pair's relative visual anonymity, however, 61 Cygni has great historical significance. The reason for this quiet fame is that this faint star system was the first to have its distance from Earth measured by parallax. Friedrich Bessel is best known to a physicist or mathematician for his work on the mathematical functions that bear his name. Pretty much any engineering or physical problem that involves a cylindrical or spherical geometry ends up with the use of Bessel functions, and in blissful ignorance, you will probably encounter some piece of technology that has relied on them in the design process at some point today. But Bessel was first and foremost an astronomer, being appointed director of the Königsberg Observatory at the age of only 25. In 1838, Bessel observed that 61 Cygni shifted its position in the sky by approximately two-thirds of an arc second over a period of a year as viewed from Earth. That's not very much. An arc second is 1/3600th of a degree. It is enough, however, to do a bit of trigonometry and calculate that 61 Cygni is 10.3 light-years away from our solar system. This compares very favourably with the modern measurement of the distance, 11.41 plus or minus 0.02 light-years. Parallax is so important in astronomy that there is a measurement system completely based on it, which allows you to do these sums in your head. Astronomers use a distance measurement known as a parsec, which stands for per arc second. This is the distance of a star from the Sun that has a parallax of 1 arc second. 1 parsec is 3.26 light-years. Bessel's measurement of the parallax of 61 Cygni was 0.314 arc seconds, and this immediately implies that it's around 10 light-years away. Even today, stellar parallax remains the most accurate way of determining the distance to nearby stars, because it is a direct measurement which uses only trigonometry and requires no assumptions or physical models. On the 19th of December 2013, the Gaia Space Telescope was launched on a Soyuz rocket from French Guiana. The mission will measure, by parallax, the positions and motions of 1 billion stars in our galaxy over 5 years. This data will provide an accurate and dynamic 3D map of the galaxy, which in turn will allow for an exploration of the history of the Milky Way, because Newton's laws, which govern the motions of all these stars under the gravitational pull of each other, can be run backwards as well as forwards in time. Given precise measurements of the positions and velocities of 1% of the stars in the Milky Way, it is possible to ask what the configuration of the stars looked like millions or even billions of years ago. This enables astronomers to build simulations of the evolution of our galaxy, revealing its history of collisions and mergers with other galaxies over 13 billion years, stretching back to the beginning of the universe. Newton and Bessel would have loved it. Stellar parallax, when deployed using a 21st century orbiting observatory, is a powerful technique for mapping our galaxy out to distances of many thousands of light years. Beyond our galaxy, however, the distances are far too great to employ this direct method of distance measurement. In the mid-19th century, this might have appeared an insurmountable problem, but science doesn't proceed by measurement alone. As Newton so powerfully demonstrated, scientific progress often proceeds through the interaction between theory and observation. Newton's law of gravitation is a theory. In physics, this usually means a mathematical model that can be applied to explain or predict the behavior of some part of the natural world. How might we measure the mass of a planet? We can't weigh it directly. But given Newton's laws, we can determine the planet's mass very accurately if it has a moon. The logic is quite simple. The moon's orbit clearly has something to do with the planet's gravity, which in turn has something to do with its mass. These relationships are encoded in Newton's law, and careful observation of the moon's orbit around the planet therefore allows for the planet's mass to be determined. For the more mathematical reader, the equation is m planet plus m moon equals 4 pi squared a cubed over g p squared, where a is the time average distance between the planet and the moon, g is Newton's gravitational constant, and p is the period of the orbit. This equation is in fact Kepler's third law, discovered empirically by Kepler in 1619. Kepler's laws can be derived from Newton's law of gravitation. Under the assumption that the mass of the planet is far larger than the mass of the moon, this equation allows for the mass of the planet to be measured. This is how theoretical physics can be used to extract measurements from observation, given a mathematical model of the system. To measure the distance to objects that are too far away to use parallax, therefore, we need to find a theory or mathematical relationship that allows for a measurement of something, anything, to be related to distance. The first relationship of this type, which opened the door to all other methods of distance measurement out to the edge of the observable universe, was discovered at the end of the 19th century by an American astronomer named Henrietta Leavitt. Searching for patterns in starlight. The Earth is replete with features named after rogues, because history is the province of the rich and powerful, and the deserving rarely become either. To find more worthy geographical nomenclature, it is necessary to look further afield, to a place that escaped the attention of the vain. The dark side of the moon is such a place, because nobody had seen it until the Soviet spacecraft Luna 3 photographed it in 1959. It isn't dark, by the way. It permanently faces away from Earth due to an effect called tidal locking, and receives the same amount of sunlight as the familiar Earth-facing side. The first humans to see it were the crew of Apollo 8, when Bill Anders memorably described it as looking like a sand pile my kids have played in for some time. It's all beat up, no definition, just a lot of bumps and holes. Lacking the smooth lunar maria, the dark side is an expanse of craters, and many of these have been named entirely appropriately after deserving scientists. Giordano Bruno is there, of course, alongside Pasteur, Hertz, Millikan, D'Alembert, Planck, Pauli, van der Waals, Poincaré, Leibniz, van der Graaf, and Landau. Arthur Schuster, the father of the physics department at the University of Manchester, is honoured. And tucked away in the southern hemisphere, next to a plane named Apollo, is a 65-kilometre-wide, partly eroded crater called Leavitt. Henrietta Swan Leavitt was one of the Harvard computers, a group of women employed to work at the Harvard College Observatory by Professor Edward Charles Pickering. By the late 19th century, Harvard had collected a large amount of data in the form of photographic plates, but the professional astronomers had neither the time nor resources to process the reams of material. Pickering's answer was to hire women as skilled and cheap analysts. Scottish astronomer Wilhelmina Fleming was his first recruit, whom he employed after proclaiming that even his maid could do a better job than the overworked males at the observatory. Fleming became a respected astronomer. She was made an honorary member of the Royal Astronomical Society in London, and amongst many important published works, discovered the Horsehead Nebula in Orion. Buoyed by this successful policy, Pickering continued to expand his computers throughout the later years of the 19th century, bringing Henrietta Leavitt into the team in 1893. Pickering assigned her to the study of stars known as variables, whose brightness changes over a period of days, weeks, or months. In 1908, Leavitt published a paper based on a series of observations of variable stars in the Small Magellanic Cloud, which we now know to be a satellite galaxy of the Milky Way. It consists of a detailed list of the positions and periods of 1,777 variable stars, and towards the end, a brief but extremely important observation. It is worthy of note that in Table 6, the brighter variables have the longer periods. It is also noticeable that those having the longest periods appear to be as regular in their variations as those which pass through their changes in a day or two. This discovery immediately caught the interest of Pickering, and for good reason. If a star's intrinsic brightness is known, then it is a simple matter to calculate its distance. Put very simply, the further away an object is, the dimmer it appears. Levitt and Pickering published a more detailed study in 1912, in which they proposed a simple mathematical relationship between the period and intrinsic brightness of 25 variable stars. This relationship is known as the period-luminosity relation. All that was required to calibrate the relation was a parallax measurement of the distance to a single variable of the type observed by Levitt. If this could be achieved, then the distance to the Small Magellanic Cloud could be obtained. In 1913, the Danish astronomer Einar Hertzsprung, in a spectacularly accurate piece of astronomical observing, managed to measure the distance by parallax to the well-known variable star Delta Cephei. Delta Cephei has a period of 5.366341 days and lies 890 light-years from Earth, according to modern measurements by the Hubble Space Telescope. Because of its historic place as the first of Levitt's variable stars to have its distance measured, these stars are now known as Cepheid variables. Inexplicably, even though Hertzsprung managed to get the parallax measurement and the distance to Delta Cephei correct, his published paper quotes the distance to the Small Magellanic Cloud as 3,000 light-years, which is badly wrong. The modern-day measurement is 170,000 light-years. There is speculation that Hertzsprung made a simple typographical error in the paper and for some reason couldn't be bothered to correct it. In any case, the technique had been established, and 2 years later Harlow Shapley published the first of a series of papers that refined the method and led him to the first measurement of the size and shape of the Milky Way. He concluded that the galaxy is a disk of stars around 300,000 light-years in extent, with the Sun positioned around 50,000 light-years from the centre. This is roughly correct. The Milky Way is around 100,000 light-years across, and the Sun is about 25,000 light-years from the centre. This was an important moment in the history of astronomy, because it was the first measurement that relegated the solar system from being the centre of everything. It's true that few, if any, astronomers would have claimed otherwise by the turn of the 20th century, but science is a subject that relies on measurement rather than opinion. The journey into insignificance had begun. Beyond the Milky Way. With the size and shape of the galaxy measured, the question of our place in creation now shifted from the position of the Sun within the galaxy to the nature of the universe itself. If the progress from Copernicus through Newton to Levitt and Shapley appears relatively fast, certainly when viewed in the context of the glacial progress through the 2,000-year dominance of Aristotelian thinking, then the decade that followed Shapley's determination of the size of the Milky Way might be described as an intellectual avalanche. The revolution was fueled from two sides. A new generation of telescopes and the increasingly sophisticated observational techniques developed by astronomers like Levitt, Hertzsprung and Shapley provided the data, and in parallel, theoretical physics experienced a revolution. Claims of revolutions or paradigm shifts have to be made with great care in science. Indeed, the terminology is quite unfashionable in certain academic circles. But from a physicist's perspective, there is no doubt that physics experienced a revolution in 1915, because in November of that year, Albert Einstein presented a new theory of gravity to the Prussian Academy of Science. The theory is known as general relativity, and it replaces Newton's law of universal gravitation. Many physicists regard general relativity as the most beautiful piece of physics yet devised by the human mind, and we will explore why this is so a little later. For now, let us note that the Big Bang, the expanding universe, black holes, gravitational waves, and the whole evocative landscape of 21st century cosmological language began, absolutely, with the publication of general relativity. The parallels with the Newtonian revolution are clear. Without Newton's laws, there is no deep understanding of the solar system and the motions of the planets. Without general relativity, there is no deep understanding of the large-scale structure and behavior of the universe. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. As the second decade of the 20th century dawned, the size and shape of the Milky Way galaxy was established, albeit with rather large errors, but the true extent of the universe beyond our galaxy was still hotly debated. Could we at least cling to a sort of token pre-Copernican fig leaf and place our galaxy at the centre of the universe? The desire to be special runs deep. The last intellectual rearguard action against our demotion can, rather theatrically, be said to have been played out on a single evening on the 26th of April 1920 in the Baird Auditorium at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, Washington, D.C. This is, of course, an oversimplification, but allow me a minute to enjoy the sound of the outraged, shaking jowls of 1,000 historians of science before I qualify and partially justify this hyperbolic claim. The Great Debate. The history of science is littered with crunching moments of conflict, debates, and disagreements that divided opinion in the most passionate of battles. The wonderful thing about science, however, is that the debates can be settled when facts become available. Science and conservative common sense famously clashed in 1860 when Thomas Huxley and Samuel Wilberforce fulminated over the new theory of evolution published by Darwin 7 months earlier. I imagine Wilberforce's indignant reddening cheeks shaking with righteous outrage as he denied the repugnant possibility that his grandfather was a monkey. None of his relatives was a chimpanzee, by the way. We simply share a common ancestor with them around 6 or 7 million years ago. But the unctuous, oleaginous and saponaceous bishop, as Disraeli once called him, was having none of it. This might be a little unfair to the great Victorian orator and bishop of the Church of England, but in the case of evolution, he was firmly on the wrong side of reality. Few great leaps in knowledge occur without dividing opinion, and this is entirely appropriate. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and the great scientific discoveries we are celebrating here are utterly extraordinary. The trick, as an educated citizen of the 21st century, is to realise that nature is far stranger and more wonderful than human imagination, and the only appropriate response to new discoveries is to enjoy one's inevitable discomfort, take delight in being shown to be wrong, and learn something as a result. The world of astronomy had its moment of intellectual sumo in what has become known as the Great Debate. The year was 1920, and two eminent astronomers found themselves stuck on a train together, travelling the 4,000 kilometres from California to Washington to discuss the greatest cosmological question of the day. The younger of the two men, Harlow Shapley, we have already met. He had just published his data suggesting that the Milky Way galaxy was much larger than previously suspected. This, however, was where he believed the universe stopped. Shapley was convinced our galaxy was the beginning and end of the cosmos. His travelling companion thought otherwise. Heber Curtis had been studying a misty patch of light known as the Andromeda Nebula. He was convinced that this was not part of our galaxy, but a separate island universe of billions of other stars. It's not known what they discussed on the train, but the debate itself took place at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History throughout the day and night of the 26th of April. At stake was the scale of the universe itself, and both men knew that the question would ultimately be settled by evidence rather than debating skills. The human race had already been shunted from the centre of the universe by Copernicus, and now faced the possibility that the Milky Way galaxy itself was part of a multitude, stretching across millions of light-years of space. The question wasn't settled that evening, but the experienced Curtis, perceived as the underdog because of the magnitude of what he was suggesting, landed significant blows. Curtis observed that the Andromeda Nebula contains a number of novae, exploding stars that shine temporarily but brightly in the night sky. But he also noted that the novae in Andromeda appeared on average to be 10 times fainter than any others. Curtis asserted that Andromeda's novae appear dimmer simply because they are perhaps 500,000 light-years further away than those in the Milky Way. Andromeda is therefore another galaxy, claimed Curtis, which strongly implied that the other so-called nebulae were other galaxies too. This was the very definition of an extraordinary claim, and the extraordinary evidence came only 4 years later. In 1923, A photo of Andromeda, taken by a 33-year-old astronomer called Edwin Hubble, further fueled the great debate. It's only a photograph, but just like Anders' Earthrise, it belongs to a rarefied group of images that have transformed our perspective. Aside from their scientific merit, such images assume great cultural significance because of the ideas they generate and the philosophical and ideological challenges they pose. They also carry with them, in the shadows, personal stories. Someone would have taken a photograph of Andromeda someday and discovered what Hubble did. But Hubble took this one, and his story therefore becomes inextricably intertwined with it. Some don't like their history presented in this way, but science is richer when its stories include people as well as ideas. Curiosity is, after all, a human virtue. Hubble may never have taken the photograph had he followed through on a promise to his father to practice law. Reading jurisprudence at Queen's College, Oxford, as one of the first Rhodes scholars,